Hi, everybody. Welcome to March's episode of Arizona MCAST. We're back with some fresh new material after taking a little hiatus in February for some board review. I'd like to say happy March and happy match to all three emergency medicine programs at the University of Arizona. We were fortunate enough to score some amazing new interns, so we'd like to take a quick second to welcome them all and give them an idea of what we're doing. This is Arizona MCAST. This is a monthly emergency medicine podcast produced for the University of Arizona Department of Emergency Medicine, but we hope it's useful for any and all emergency practitioners. It's full of EM Corps content, approaches to common and life-threatening issues that you'll see in the emergency department, and practical advice for the real world. This podcast is geared towards preparing you for your next shift, your next year, and your next job. We incorporate our nurses, medics, consultants, and anyone else that we can wrangle in to make this a well-rounded and clinically useful educational experience. We also supplement our opinions with evidence and try to differentiate between the two. When you hear this, you'll see an article on the screen of whatever device you're using. I encourage you to take a screenshot of that info and look up the paper on your own to make sure Jared and I aren't just blowing smoke. If you hear this, we probably are blowing some smoke, or we're just giving you our own opinion that you'll have to take or leave depending on your own experience and your view of the literature. Finally, we end with the master Brian Drummond giving us his peer review on the episode to keep us even more honest. So myself, Dr. Jared Mosier, and Dr. Brian Drummond, as well as all the other contributors that we're going to have on this series, hope that we can give you a good experience and help supplement your education during residency, during nursing, or doing whatever else it is that you do in Tucson and outside of Tucson to take care of sick patients. Now, with all that hype to live up to, let's talk about this month. Jared and I discussed the case of a perfectly healthy 20-year-old male with athlete's foot. No, I'm just kidding. We discussed the management of an osmolar and electrolyte disaster in the making, followed by a brief review and a rant on fluid resuscitation in the ED. To help round us out, we've spoken to some of our alumni who are now providers in the community to ask them what they do about issues related to electrolytes, dehydration, creatinine levels, and the like. These are people that are now practicing as attendings that were once emergency medicine residents at the U of A, just like you. But enough talk. Let's get to the meat of the program, which we hope you enjoy.
A million ways to die.
That went south so fast!
Congratulations, Jared.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You're coming up soon, right?
I am. Charity's due in April, so we're going to pre-record some stuff for probably the next year so that we can get through with infanthood. So sorry if our stuff is outdated come, I don't know, December or so of this year.
So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
Yeah, exactly. If we don't see Let's record some standardized lines that we can just clip in later. So congratulations to all of you residents for finishing the in-service exam. I actually had several residents say that the stuff we talked about was on the exam, and I told them
I told them
that's because we broke in and stole the tests like a bad '80s sitcom. So
I highly doubt I could pass that exam. What do you think?
No, I don't think I'd do very well. They said the ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome was on the exam.
Was it really?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't at all.
I was about to just get up and run around, take my shirt off and run around.
It's a small office. Don't do that. All right, so I got the case this month. People are going to be so sick of acid-based stuff by the time we're done with this podcast. I think we will be done with this at someday.
We could change it to the acid-based podcast.
Oh, just kill me now.
AZAB podcast.
All right, so this is a fascinating young lady. So this is a 56-year-old woman.
This is an adult.
Okay, right. Yes. So this is a 56-year-old woman who I get the phone call that she's coming in from the cancer center for elevated blood sugars, too high to count. So I'm waiting for the lady to come in, and I go. She's our cancer center, so I go and check her labs because we can do that through our system. So I look through her chart, and the patient has a history of multiple myeloma and chronic kidney disease. And her most recent BUN and creatinine as of a month ago was 49 and 2.7 for a creatinine. So her labs today are sodium of 116, potassium 4.2, chloride of 83, bicarb of 20,
Beer and creatinine of 51 and 3.7, a little bit up from last time, and a glucose of 1,291.
Nice. What's her albumin?
Her albumin was 3.2, so not terrible.
Tiny gap.
Yeah, a little bit. So all I know is this lady's coming in. So my thoughts right off the bat are this lady is probably going to be fairly sick, or they drew this off of her existing line and forgot to flush it, and they've got tons of sugar in the line. This was her TPN line or something. So I'm getting ready for this lady to come in, and sure enough, she comes in, and she looks like a peach. She looks wonderful. She's sitting up in bed. She's telling me how she feels. She wants something to eat, of course, because her glucose is 1,300. And she says for the past 3 days, she's had fatigue, malaise, and increased urine output for 3 days. She's just peeing all the time.
So she needs four liters of fluid?
4 liters of fluid right off the bat. Now, so what do you want to do for this lady first?
So, you know, I want to make sure that blood sugar is real.
Right. So that's my hope, too, is maybe someone drew this off the line. Happens a lot from nursing homes, happens when people draw after their PIC lines. So what I did, instead of repeating the labs from the port, I got a finger stick blood sugar.
Mm-hmm. And what was it?
High.
Greater than 500 then.
Yep. So maybe not 1,300, but definitely higher than normal. So it's not a normal sugar. The reason you want to do this and not trust the lab is it's real hard to screw up a finger stick blood sugar. You have to have really bad machine or expired strips or something terrible, or you have to like drop syrup onto the strip and try to run it that way. So if you start insulin on this lady just based on her reported sugar, if it's normal because they drew it off the line, you're going to be treating a seizure in a little bit.
Is she on insulin at home?
She's not. She's never had any problems with her sugar whatsoever, but the HemOnc note does say that she got pulse steroids a while ago for her multiple myeloma.
How much?
I don't know.
All right. Probably not a gram or anything like that.
I'm not sure.
Okay, so my question to you is she dehydrated or is she volume depleted?
So the question there is she intravascularly volume depleted or is she total body dehydrated, meaning intracellularly?
Yeah, does she have a free water problem or does she have a volume problem?
That's what I was going to ask the ICU when I admitted her to the ICU.
Well, so you can get a sense of that based on the sodium, right? So what's her corrected sodium? Her sodium right now is 116. Let's go off a blood sugar of 1,300. Mm-hmm. The correction that we all learn is what 2.5 for every 100 over 100, right?
Over 200.
But that's actually wrong. If you look at the studies where they did that, it's like 1 per 100 until you get to 400, and then it's 4 per 100 after that. So let's just say take 2.5 per 100, and so she is 116, so 2.5, so that'd be 5, so that'd be 121, okay? And then now from 400 to 1,300 is 800. So multiply by 4 is what, 32? So add 32 to 121 is 153. So her real sodium is around 153. So she is dehydrated. And that doesn't mean she can't be volume depleted as well. So is she volume depleted? Do you think that she would respond to volume or that she needs volume?
So I would say that she's definitely intracellularly dry because she's got a diuresis with this hyperosmolar state. But my feeling for her is however she got this, this has happened over several days. Her vital signs, by the way, looked great. She wasn't tachycardic. She wasn't hypotensive. So I opted to not just do something but stand there.
She's not in shock, right? She's not making lactate. She's not tachypneic. She doesn't have any signs of peripheral perfusion. So she's intracellularly dry. She's dehydrated. Mm-hmm. She might be intravascularly dry, but she's not in shock. So you're electing to not bolus her.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so what did you get? What did you do?
So first thing I did is I canceled the bolus that was written.
For 2 liters?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I actually wrote for 500.
Okay.
Because I have a personal opinion that if you look well and and you're in this state of a chronic osmolar or electrolyte or volume depletion, that fixing you right off the bat is probably not going to be the best thing for you.
Mm-hmm. And she has chronic kidney disease as well, mm-hmm. so right. I don't think there's literature to argue against you. So,
or for me.
Or for you. So what fluid did you give?
So I started with NS because I'm a very simple ER doc.
So this is interesting. We just said that her sodium is 150-something. So if you give her LR, that's relatively hypotonic, and so there's some free water in there. But if you give her saline, that's isotonic, and so you're not giving her any free water. You're giving her an isotonic fluid, and eventually her sodium will come down a little bit. So I think you're fine in either of those. But what if somebody wants to give albumin? Well, she has multiple myeloma, so her protein levels are fine. She doesn't have a hypoproteinemia that needs to be fixed for oncotic pressure. So I think any fluid that you choose is fine with her.
So my thought was, let's treat her slowly. So the first thing I had was, does she need a bolus? And I said, no, she doesn't need a bolus. But we bolus people in the ED all the time. So I ended up requesting that we just do a mini bolus, 500 mLs, and see how she does, and then start her on maintenance fluids to gradually lower her sugars. The next question is...
She's 56 with chronic kidney disease. That's a bolus.
Yeah, that's a good-sized bolus. So the next question is, does she need insulin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she's got a wicked high blood sugar, but is she in DKA, or does she just need her her glucose thinned out a little bit and cut with a little bit of water to turn her maple syrup into something that's more like grenadine?
If you think she has hyperosmolar or non-ketotic, then they usually require some insulin. And what I usually do is half the DKA dose, so 0.05 per kilo.
So the question that was brought up to me is, should we bolus her with some insulin?
No.
So that was my thought as well. And again, it's, what's your hurry? Are you trying to correct her so that she can go home? I'm not sending this lady home. Mm-hmm. So what's the hurry? Let's bring her down slowly. Let's let her body acclimate to this. And that's kind of what we did. And this kind of takes us into a big discussion that we are now going to have on fluids.
They've done studies, 60% of the time, it works every time.
That doesn't make sense.
This next segment, Jared and I are going to talk about a flurry of articles that all deal with fluid resuscitation in the ED. So remember, there's going to be these screenshots on your phone or your tablet or your computer, whatever you're using to listen to this podcast, that you can take a screenshot of so that you can look at it later. It's going to have the author's name. It's going to have the name of the article, the name of the journal, the year that it was published. And most importantly, it's going to have the PubMed ID. So you can take this PubMed ID and you can put it into PubMed, and the article comes right up. There's no searching through the different Jones JS's to see, is this the right article? It'll come right up. Hopefully this is helpful. I encourage you not to just take our word for it, but to go read the article yourself, at least read the abstract so that you have an idea of what it is, because in this day and age, people can say anything.
We're going to talk about fluids. We talked about acid-base the last time, and then we had a little buffer. That's an acid-base joke. So we had a little buffer with the board review. So we wanted to get back to some fluid stuff because there has been some fluid-related discussion and fluid-related articles that we wanted to talk about. Most recently, our peer reviewer, Brian Drummond, made some very bold assertions about what he does for fluids and what he does for his DKA patients and a few other things. And there's been some chatter on our email listserv and on Convo about what we do for resuscitation, what kind of fluids that we use.
Yeah, and I talked about this at conference the other day, and I didn't think it deserved a whole hour, so I talked about it during the volume responsiveness lecture. And if anybody missed that and is interested to see the actual data and the graphs, you can watch it on Panopto. But here's what we know. There are some data that show that the type of fluid matters in the immune response and the consequent acid-base abnormalities. So, even Dr. Rhee's research on, I think it was LR, showed that when you give somebody a bunch of LR or any, maybe he used any crystalloid, but I think it was LR, that your cellular adhesion molecule expression changes and you have more inflammatory response. Other people have shown that the chloride in fluids can change your... One interesting thing, I think it was in dogs, and it changed the renal artery blood flow when you gave a chloride-rich fluid. Nobody really knew what that meant. There were some data that showed that maybe people weren't thinking very clearly for 24 hours, something like that, but nothing really clinically significant. But then in 2000, I think it was 2010, that study in JAMA came out that showed that people with chloride liberal fluids versus chloride sensitive fluids had a difference in the amount of acute kidney injury and renal replacement therapy. And this kind of sparked this massive debate now about, oh my God, should we change our fluids? And if you think about that, how do you study fluids? And think about all the patients that come in sick to the emergency department. How many of them got fluids pre-hospital? And that fluid's always saline. When you give them medications, the driver is always saline. So how do you study that? I mean, you would have to literally eliminate saline from pre-hospital and your emergency department or your ICU or whatever and give some other type of fluid to see if there really is a difference. So it's difficult to study. And some people think, well, maybe albumin's the answer. Albumin's horribly expensive, and the Europeans like it. There's also the starches that they seem to like, but the starches appear to cause anaphylactic reactions and more kidney injury. But the question becomes, you know, which fluid do we give, and how do you do a study to do anything other than set one of them up for failure? So take albumin, for example. If you were going to do a study, we assume that some of the problem with the fluids that we give are the volume of fluids. But if you're going to do a study and to get that through the IRB, you really say we're going to give the same volume of fluid, we're just going to give either albumin or saline. That really only sets albumin up to be a failure, or at least no different, which is why you see in all these studies that there's no different, or maybe there's a little noise there, maybe a little signal in that noise that there's a difference. So the Albios trial that was just finished, they presented the results at SUCM, was a similar instance. They wanted to compare saline versus albumin in severe sepsis and septic shock. The reason being that in the SAFE study that was done in Australia showed overall no difference when you used albumin versus saline for all patients, but trauma patients did definitely worse. So if one group does definitely worse and there's an overall no difference, that means another group had to have done better. And it turns out that group was the severe sepsis patients. It just wasn't powered to be statistically significant. So that was the Albios trial, was to answer that. But they couldn't get it through the regulatory boards without saying, okay, we're going to look at albumin supplementation or repletion versus saline. So everybody got saline, and then one group got their albumin repleted to a normal level.
Which is not exactly the same.
No, it's not the same thing at all. And what they had shown was there was a small difference, like a 6 or 7% difference in mortality if you repleted somebody's albumin in addition to saline. So that didn't really answer the question. But it appears when you take the body of literature together, there are a couple large retrospective studies and one prospective study in surgical patients and in medical patients where if you completely eliminate the saline from your ICU and you do a pre and post, that the patients who got more balanced fluids did better. And it appears that the problem is chloride. It causes the strong ion thing, causes problems with that. Mostly it causes acid-base abnormalities, and chloride is the problem. So what do we give? And what do we think? Well, here's what I think. I think that for small volume resuscitations, 1 to 3 or 4 liters, it probably does not matter at this point in time. Maybe literature, maybe next year we're having a different conversation. But in 2015, I think for small volume resuscitations, saline is perfectly fine. If you start getting up to where you're giving 5, 6, 7 liters, and that's just an arbitrary threshold that I've come up with, and there's a review, or it's a retrospective study in intensive care medicine where it appeared that it was the chloride load and the volume that made the difference. So as you start getting higher volumes, you start giving more total chloride, and that's where the mortality comes from. So as your resuscitation becomes a large volume resuscitation, I would say you could consider changing fluids. And what do you change to? Well, if you give 5% albumin, that's still a chloride-rich fluid. It's 95% saline. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to give albumin, you give 25% albumin. LR, you could give plasmolite is really the one, or Hartmann solution, which I don't think we have that. We have plasmolite. So you could give plasmolite, but it's much more expensive. So that's what I recommend. Right now, it appears there's a lot of noise. It appears there's a signal. That signal appears to be chloride's bad. And for small volume resuscitations in the emergency department, it probably doesn't matter. As your resuscitation becomes large volume, maybe you consider changing fluid.
So the patient that comes in with some gastro and has vomited and diarrheaed out a liter or so, they're going to do okay. But the patient that has had issues with severe sepsis and their tank is completely empty, and not only is their tank empty but their pipes have kind of widened and the resistance is low, they are going to need more fluids. And you're saying that once you get to a point, you may actually fare better without the extra chloride that you're going to get from saline.
Yes.
So in the ED we can start with missiles and then switch to guns if we get too close.
Yeah, what I generally do, I do this all the time in the ICU, and for the most part I do it in the emergency department too, but if I check their albumin's less than 2, they get 25% albumin from me. And I think that the literature is strong enough on albumin that the pharmacist can't really argue with you about that. If their albumin's 3, giving them albumin's probably not going to be fruitful for you.
I agree with you that we cause a lot of problems by giving too much crystalloid. Is there any point at which you should replace these with not just an albumin colloid, but with something else, some kind of a blood product?
That's a good question. This is a sensitive topic, being that our new management has a mission to decrease the amount of blood, and you know I love me some blood. So
Jared sends me a text while we're getting our hand down from the higher ups that we're using too much blood, that says ECMO uses a lot of blood.
Yeah, I have a lot of meetings in my future, I think. But so here's my take on blood. All the literature on giving blood is in critical ill patients is done in patients who are already volume resuscitated, and then they're just trying to transfuse to a target threshold. And I think that's asking the wrong question. The right question is, are there some patients that would do better with blood? Here are a few people that I think, just my opinion, I mean, you could put the opinion ding on there, but my opinion is that if you have somebody that you ask the question, does this patient need fluid? The answer is yes. And the second question is, would they respond to it? That answer is yes. And the third question is, do they have something that would make me limit my resuscitation? Diastolic heart failure or something like that. And you think, if I give them a bunch of fluid, it's going to end up in the lungs. And you look with bedside echo, and their cardiac output appears to be high. I think that patient should be resuscitated with a blood product. I think that there's no literature to say that that's bad, just as much as there's no literature to say that that's good. And so that's when I reach to. If I think somebody's hemoglobin is 7 or 8 or whatever, and their cardiac output is 11 liters per minute, and they're making a bunch of lactate, and they've got diastolic heart failure, I will give them blood.
So let's talk about, while we're talking about resuscitations, let's talk about the nail in the coffin, as it were, for the exact EGD protocol. So EGD came out in 2001, the Rivers article. We talked about the process and arise a few months ago, and now the PROMISE trial is the third one.
Which was England.
We were joking about earlier, how many multi-center randomized controlled prospective trials does it take to kill some poor guy's effort at trying to save septic people. So this is saying more of what the ARISE trial and the PROCESS trial already said. What is helpful for septic patients? Recognize that they're septic. Give them fluids and antibiotics up front. There's not really a whole lot more to say about it, and I kind of feel bad for the people that did the PROMISE trial. Maybe if they would have gotten their stuff out first, people would have like read it more instead of looking at the conclusion and saying, okay, more of this.
You feel bad for them because they have the lead article in the New England Journal?
I do. I mean, you know, some people get all the luck.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to go through it in grave detail just so Brian Drummond has to listen to it, but we'll spare you the details and just say that the one different thing about, or actually two different things about this trial, granted I haven't read it in grave detail yet because I've been busy with a newborn, but
excuses.
Their mortality was a touch higher in both groups than the other two trials. They were around 30% versus 20% for both groups. And then they are the only ones to really look at cost effectiveness, and they showed that early goal-directed therapy was more expensive. I don't know what to make of that. Personally, I don't really care about the cost effectiveness if it saves lives.
ECMO,
exactly. but I will say this. The arguments that people have against the other trials, and this one included, are one that, well, the mortality wasn't the same as the Rivers trial. Now, so I got asked to review a paper for one of the emergency medicine journals, and they had dismissed the Process and Arise trials for this reason, the generalizability of them for that reason, that, oh, you know, we don't really know exactly how it compares because the mortality wasn't the same as the early goal-directed therapy trials. And my response to that in my review was, you know, you have thousands of patients here, and you're going to dismiss the results over thousands of patients because of a proof of concept trial 15 years ago that in 130 patients.
That's like dismissing any pneumonia trial because it doesn't stack up against the mortality of the pre-penicillin era pneumonia studies.
The Rivers trial, I will give it all the respect in the world it deserves because it deserves a ton. It has changed our practice, but it was 14 years ago and it was 130 patients in each group.
During a time when people didn't realize sepsis was something we could fix.
Right. Now we have thousands of patients between these three studies. And the other argument that people give is that, well, the usual care groups all got early goal-directed therapy. That may or may not be true. But even if they did get aggressive therapy that resembled early goal-directed therapy, it was no different than the patients who really got early goal-directed therapy. And now this PROMISE trial shows that it was less expensive. And so I think exactly what you say, early identification, early fluid resuscitation, if they would respond to it, and early antibiotics.
So moving from this, let's talk about one other thing that I know is one of your pet peeves. So let's talk about your bolus and who needs to be bolused and with how much. And this is definitely going to be a lot of opinion. One of the things that I know you get on your soapbox about is, why do we start with 2 liters and then walk away? Brian brought up the last time about how he likes to bolus people right up front. They're diabetics, they're in DKA, they're dehydrated. Let's bolus them, let's get them going. My opinion is, if you've got a condition where you have been dehydrated over the course of several days to several weeks, like DKA, or any other kind of condition like that, if you have electrolyte disturbances that have acclimated, your body's acclimated to over several days to weeks, and if you're not acutely decompensating, you're not acutely hypotensive, you're not acutely with poor perfusion, why do you need a bolus?
You know, you're right. Our unit of currency somewhere along the way became 2 liters, and I don't know where, I don't know why, I don't know. But for some reason, we've made everything 2 liters. You open an Epic order set, it's a 2 liter bolus. When you have to really make an effort to make it less than 2 liters. But the question is, does a patient need a bolus? And if you go to PubMed and you look at that, there are very few studies that look at bolus versus no bolus. So the one that really freaked us all out was that study in Africa, the FEAST trial, which, yeah, there were a lot of malarial sepsis and meningococcus, and it was Africa, I think it was sub-Saharan Africa or whatever, but they showed that people who got bolus, whether it was albumin, saline, didn't matter, they died more often than people who didn't. And, you know, they don't have ventilators and stuff like that. And so what's the...
They also got a lot more blood.
And so we all kind of took a step back and thought, I don't really know what to do with this, but this appears that bolusing is bad. There's another study, EMS study, pre-hospital study in King County, where they looked about patients with severe sepsis or severe sepsis plus hypotension. Or they looked at all patients with hypotension or severe sepsis, and what they found was, pre-hospital, does putting in an IV or putting in an IV and giving a bolus make a difference? And what they showed that was, for patients who have severe sepsis and are hypotensive, putting in an IV and giving a bolus made a difference. For patients that weren't hypotensive, there's a little bit of a signal there that they did kind of worse if they got a bolus, if they weren't hypotensive. I don't really know what to make of that, but that study showed that giving a bolus appeared to be the thing to do. And there's another study, I can't remember the exact details of it, in pediatrics, that they got boluses. So it appears that giving a bolus is the way to go.
So I think looking at some of this, you just have to ask the question, why do we bolus and walk away? Well, because we're busy and because it's easy. It's easier to put in for 2-liter bolus and then walk away than it is to stand there and give 500 ml challenges. For a lot of these patients, you can kind of ask yourself, do they really need the bolus? I would argue that a patient that's lost a liter or two of vomitus and diarrhea in 24 hours, they probably will feel better with a bolus because they haven't lost their volume and acclimated to it. They feel terrible because they acutely lost their volume. So give it acutely back. But the patient that's in rhabdo or that's been a border crosser and has been out losing fluid over time, or even just somebody that's been out in the sun and is dehydrated over a long period, they will, this is theoretical, and I'll challenge people with this, they would theoretically do better with resuscitative fluids over time instead of all their fluids right up front.
And probably orally.
Yeah. Orally would certainly be best, but some people need the supplementation. So I would challenge those of you that are listening to consider if a patient's not hypotensive with signs of poor perfusion and they need their tank filled now, if you're going to admit them anyway, just start them on some aggressive maintenance fluids instead of an aggressive bolus.
All these studies that look at boluses in animals that show that boluses restore oxygen, tissue oxygen tension and whatnot, they're all lipopolysaccharide-induced sepsis models. But you're right, the patient who's got diarrhea and is a few liters down, that question has not been answered. And one of the unintended consequences, I think, of all the assessments of volume responsiveness that we do is that, you know, it's kind of a result of the CVP thing. You know how I feel about CVP, but it used to be that you needed a CVP of 8. So, damn it, we're going to give fluids until the CVP is 8. And then people started coming along saying, oh, well, if you ultrasound the IVC, if you do the LVOT, VTI, these kinds of things that show variability, that's better. But the consequence has been, well, we used to give fluids until the CVP is 8. So now we give fluids until those variability responses are no longer. That question is probably needs to be looked at, that when is enough enough?
Mm-hmm. And it's tough because you got to find a different gold standard. Right. If you say, well, now this is the gold standard, but we're not sure if it's actually working, well, then what is your gold standard? You know, what you mentioned blood earlier. Right off the bat, how much blood do we give? Someone needs blood?
Oh, 2 units.
2 units, right? I mean, their H&H is, their hemoglobin is 7.1. No, they're okay. They're totally fine. Now it's 6.8. Well, give 2 units.
Okay.
So you could argue that it's probably better to give short boluses and reassess. One of the things I think that Promise and Arise and Process have shown is that early recognition, early fluid hydration is good, but probably also frequent reassessment of these patients. These patients are intensely studied, and they're not just left to die in a corner. I guarantee you the people that did those studies did not just write for 2 liters and then walk away. Frequent reassessment is probably going to be your best bet to look at perfusion. So this is interesting, probably not even Scholar Quest because no one's going to be around to do all this for 3 years. But an interesting thing to consider is who do you bolus and why? And my beef, which I will again volley back to you, Brian, is if you've got a diabetic child who is in DKA and they've gotten to that place over the course of several days, what's your hurry? Why are you trying to bolus them if you they're not hypotensive and they're not showing signs of poor perfusion? Yeah, they're dehydrated, but you're going to have to rehydrate them over the course of at least a day, if not longer. So what's your hurry? If the patient's going to be admitted, what's your hurry?
I showed a graph in my lecture the other day that I had ripped off from Derek Angus in his lecture at SCCM, and he took the major sepsis trials. Promise hadn't come out yet, but he took the ARISE, the Jones trial that looked at lactate versus SVO2, and Process trial, which he was the lead investigator in. And he took all the fluids that the patients got, and he made a bell curve. And if you looked, the median was something like 2 liters or something, but if you look between the 33rd and 66th percentile, that range was 500 mLs to 7 liters. So you're anywhere in there with just one standard deviation. And so to say that every patient needs two or three or four liters is just crazy talk.
You know, seeing 30 patients a shift as an academic attending, sometimes 40, sometimes 45, it can be easy to say, well, let's just walk away. I got other things to do. And as a busy attending who actually has to do their own charts in a community ED, it might be easier to just do that. But you got to think of when cutting corners is actually going to be beneficial to the patient and when it's actually going to harm them.
Yeah, I'm going to preempt Drummond here because I know, I think I have a feeling what his response is going to be. He's going to say, well, most patients do fine with 2 liters. That is true. Most of your patients, maybe almost all of your patients, will do fine with 2 liters. But some of your patients will do worse with 2 liters. And my question to you, and it's, there's no right answer here. I have my opinion, but there's no right answer, is do you want to practice medicine for the majority, or do you want to be able to take care of all your patients?
Which one's harder? Now, I think that the more you get into extremes, the more you're going to cause problems if you try to do it cookie-cutter medicine. If you've got a small child, if you've got a frail patient with very bad diastolic heart failure, if you've got people that are on extremes of physiology, you're going to see your interventions amplified in their physiology. So the healthy 20-year-old that would have done fine with 2 liters is not necessarily going to you're not going to get the same response as you would from an elderly person with heart failure that you give 2 liters. The more you get into extremes of physiology, the more you have to be cautious with what you do. That doesn't mean this patient's too sick for me to take care of him. Just kind of have your spidey sense and go, this is a patient that has me a bit more nervous. So, no, I'm not afraid, Brian, but I want to take it more slowly. You can always give more. You can't take it back.
Exactly.
So there you have Jared in my practice, and you've got a brief survey of the literature on fluid resuscitation in the ED. But to give you a little extra opinion, we asked some of our community alumni what they do in their practice. So these doctors work in Phoenix, Minnesota, Hawaii, Oregon, pretty wide range of places. So we got their opinion on some fluid-related things, such as when do you recheck a creatinine or a sodium, and when do you just let it go? When do you admit an elevated creatinine or an abnormal sodium, and when do you just let it go? They give some fantastic tips, not just on these specific lab values, but on EM practice in general. We hope you enjoy.
You got a dehydrated patient. You go, we'll just check some lights, make sure that they're okay. Creatinine comes back. Say it's like 1.7. Are you going to just say, PO hydrate, give you some fluid? You're going to recheck it to make sure it goes down and buff the chart?
So there's definitely kind of a number, but you have to look. If you have no history on them,
no history.
They're relatively healthy. I would probably just hydrate them. I wouldn't even recheck it and discharge them. But I definitely have my people. I'm worried about dehydration. I'll, hit them with whatever, 2-3 liters of fluid, repeat it. As long as it's come down decently enough, I'll get them. I'll discharge them. I think that's what most people want. I'll give them follow-up with, whoever they need, and I think that's okay.
Everybody agrees?
I let them know their number was high.
Oh,
I'll often put it on their paperwork for them, and I'll tell them, recheck it with their doctor that they got some fluid, and that's probably all it was, but it should be rechecked. Kind of like urinary, blood in the urine. Like, what are you going to do with hematuria? I'm not going to call urology, but it's there. Mm-hmm. So, you had some blood in your urine, that should be rechecked by your doctor in a week. And if it's not clear, you need to see a urologist.
And I would just say all these kind of incidental findings that we don't think much of, it's important to document them. I mean, pulmonary nodules is a big one. We just had a big review at our hospital, and the nurse came to me and said, I just love that you put on all your discharge papers, because it's just an area of risk for us. It's a big area of lawsuits for us.
Mm-hmm. And you missed my lung cancer.
Right, and I can always say, hey, look, it's on your discharge papers. It tells you to follow up for this. And I always have, our scribe's document. I talk to them about it. Because now, from my perspective, I'm safe. Mm-hmm. And people should know, And
so what about, speaking of incidental labs, what sodium would you be comfortable with saying, oh, your sodium's a little bit low, you need to follow up with your doctor?
125.
Depends what they chronically are.
Yeah.
And they're altered. Yeah. Why it's low.
And the otherwise healthy patient that doesn't have a history of hyponatremia, I've always 125 for no reason. It's always either my number.
125 is your cutoff?
Uh-huh.
So Pepin says admit under 130, right. ICU under 125, So,
and that doesn't happen in any hospital in the country. Even though that's what PEPFIS says.
I think somebody at our university just wrote below, that. And I was like, I called my intensivist. I said, listen, I don't even think they need to come to you, but I kind of felt like I had a, like, at least give them the opportunity in case something happened.
Right, a first refusal.
Right. And they're like, Arthur, you know, after a liter of fluid, it's going to be up. Just admit them to the floor. I'm like, oh, perfect, documented it and done.
Get the neurology consult
for
the locked
in. I'll definitely discharge the, you know, 128, 129, especially if they've been there before. They've been 131. There's nothing magical about those numbers. And if they feel fine, like, I feel great, I'm like, eat some potato chips, go talk with your doctor. Nothing's going to happen in the next 72 hours.
I would say if I was the ICU attending, when I'm on service, if somebody calls with a hyponatremia, I'll just admit that. And because it's better for me to do it over 24 hours than have them go to the floor and then end up the other way around.
If someone calls you with a sodium 125, it's otherwise, you know, maybe weak and dizzy, yeah, and otherwise fine, you'll admit that to the ICU.
Yeah, I'm totally fine.
Jared's a sieve. Everybody take note of that.
Yeah.
You need to dispo a patient
to the ICU. You know, I think a lot of those patients are with the equivalent lab. You know, for me, 125 and less isn't equivocal, but for those patients that are, you know, 126, 127, 128, we still don't feel good about letting them go home. Whether it's hyponatremia or, you know, an elderly creatine.
It depends on the story. A lot of people weak and dizzy, and,
right,
you know, you need something to admit them for. Because
right,
if you observe will be dizzy, yeah, then you can do
that. Totally true.
A lot of those patients are just it's an extra phone call, you know, whether it's their primary care physician or the neurologist or whoever follows them. It's chronically is making that phone call and you're like, hey, your patient's in the emergency, here's this. You put it in the chart. It buffs the chart. Makes them feel good.
You know, I'll be honest. Our consultants are super conservative. Like, if you call them, you're like, what should I do? It's almost always admit them. I'll see them. You know, I think it's just more convenient for them. It's just different.
The community is a magical place.
I say this all the time. The problem with residency and the difference of the community is there's a disconnect in residency between work and pay. And in the community, that disconnect is gone. People understand, I don't work, I don't get paid. So, you know, I mean, you always have to, for sure, do what's right for the patient. But if I'm like, I don't feel good about sending this person home, they're 85, they're weak and dizzy, they had some nausea 4 days ago, and I can't find anything wrong, like, that's a tough dispo, but they're like, we have our hospice, they're like, fine, whatever. Like, they might be annoyed, especially if they've been getting pounded. They're like, fine. Like, they just know. But I just tell them, like, just like I was when I was a resident, I just say, listen, this is soft, but I don't know what to do. And they're like, okay, fine.
I think Chris and I were looking at each other because I would say our community is awesome to work at. We have a lot of specialists, but our community definitely is more aggressive of doing things as an outpatient. Like, our nephrologists know their patients. They come in super sick, and they are happy for them to come into their clinic. They don't, you know, a lot of our outpatient docs are happy handling sick patients in the community and not having them be admitted. So we send home sick people every day.
That appears to be the theme here, is that you guys have the opportunity to have them get those things addressed as an outpatient, whether it's their outpatient MRI, their outpatient nephrology, their outpatient neurologist.
It's a big adjustment moving from academics to the community, whether you're coming fresh out as a resident or somebody that stayed on after resident and worked in academics and then gone in the community. You know, that comfort of discharging patients that were just slam dunk admits when you're in the academic setting, it really takes some getting used to it. It's tough. There's very sleepless nights.
I remember Andre after he went to Northwest. Yeah, I remember him coming back and talking to me one time about it. And he was like, look, I just saw 20 dizzy 90-year-olds. I can't admit all of them, right? You got to pick the ones that really need to be in the hospital.
Happy March, everybody. This is Brian doing a little peer review on the AZM podcast. I just finished this beautiful Sobe drink. You know, it's 591 mils. It's just a nice little bolus. It got me going. But it really didn't do anything for me. But yesterday, I had a 2-liter Mountain Dew. Oh my gosh. That gave me the O sign. It was awesome. I'm just so happy that Aaron and Jared decided to be some feisty little minks this month. It was kind of nice. They're throwing stuff back at me, and you know, I didn't fall asleep this time, so it was a good month. I'm also glad I struck a nerve with them. I think this is going to be good for discussion and point counterpoint and getting some good banter back and forth. This month we're talking about IV fluids with a case on a hyperglycemic 56-year-old. I think there's a couple points we'll get through here, but I first want to talk about some of the non-IV fluid issues that they were discussing. I think with the insulin component that Jared was mentioning, most of these patients with a presumed hyperglycemic, non-ketotic state are going to need insulin, just like your DKA patients would. But how much you give and when you need to give it, that doesn't have to be your first priority. All these patients are dry and volume down, and fluid should be your first thought, and then you can start to think about insulin. The second point that Jared was talking about was he was breaking out a derivative formula. I think it had sine, cosine, a couple other things about glucose and that being high and the sodium's low. And then I got to recalculate, and if they have albumin, and maybe there's some ethanol on board because they were drinking. My take is if your glucose is really high, your sodium's probably going to be low, but it doesn't matter whether it's true, false, or real with the sodium because they all are fluid down, and you're going to give them a fluid that has sodium in it. And so probably not too important, but great for taking time to discuss and pimping med students on. Anyway, so I just treat them all as they're going to need fluid. If they have a high glucose, irrelevant what the sodium is. But it usually trends down. So now let's talk about different IV fluids and why Team AJ is into the minutiae again this month. The spoiler alert is there's still no real good evidence for any of it. Shh. All right, so let's talk about type of fluids. If you look at the Cochrane reviews, there's really no mortality difference for which type of fluid you're using. And so it probably doesn't even matter. What I think you need to know and would focus on is crystalloids for pretty much all your patients. And those can be given to everyone, assuming they don't have an allergy to normal saline or an allergy to lactated ringers, assuming you're giving 4 liters or less. And if you want to, when you're given these crystalloids, you can mix them if you want, maybe a little half and half, right? Half LR, half normal saline. You get the pros of both and the cons of neither. It's like peanut butter and jelly. It's just delicious. But if you don't, you want to stick with one, that's totally fine too. But low volume, fluid administration in the ED, crystalloids, you don't have to think anymore. Now, balanced fluids, I think, are starting to raise attention and come out, but their cost is going to have to come down and their compatibility with medications is going to have to exist for them really to take over. And at this point, I really see that, like Jared said, they're going to be used for really large volume resuscitations. Albumin, I think, has its place in special settings. Patients with low albumin, whether they're severely septic or you're doing a paracentesis, want to give them some albumin for cirrhotic patients. So patients with low albumin that are sick, maybe. And the other thing would be if you're in an environment where you can't take the weight of normal saline, whether you're backpacking or in a military setting, albumin, even though it has a higher cost, is sometimes used. Or say the hypertonic salines are used because it's less volume, so less weight that they have to carry, even though they'll take on the higher cost and possible complications with it. The only fluids I wouldn't use would be the starches. They're the ones who've been proven to have some problems in trials, and I just don't see there's a role for it in the emergency room. Team AJ decided to pepper me with some questions and throw it back into my court. Oh, that's so nice of them. So let's try to go through some of the questions that they had. Why 2 liters, Brian? You're a flip. Why are you giving this stuff? I don't know. So why do I do 2 liters? Well, I'm trying to use a pediatric weight-based system, kind of like what Aaron spent 5 years of residency doing. So I like to use 20 to 40 cc's per kilo as my initial fluid bolus, which if I took a 50 to 100 kilo person would put me at 2 liters. Now, did people start picking this out of the blue? Maybe. I don't know. That's been my practice. Do I give every single person 2 liters? No. Do I give lots of people 2 liters? Yes. Do I give some people 1 liter? Yes. Do I give people 500? Not many. Why? Because I don't see much of a difference in 500. Liter bags are available, so you can always break open, just give them 500 out of that liter and then reassess them. Are there certain populations I do 500 or 250 boluses? Yes, there are, but 2 liters is kind of my go-to, and I'll I'll talk about this a little bit where I think Team AJ was misunderstanding what I was saying. So the next question, they said, why are you bolusing him, Brian? Why are you giving these big boluses, and why are you doing it in such a hurry? Are you trying to kill kids? Are you trying to kill adults? Are you trying to fluid overload and make me put them on ECMO and dialysis? No, I'm not in a hurry. My goal is trying to prime the pump with a bolus. I am trying to stop the physiologic process that has been going on with their dehydration, whether it's volume loss from their vomiting and diarrhea, whether it's a metabolic derangement. I am trying to change that and prime the pump and then allow for an ongoing fluid resuscitation. I understand that a person with a glucose of 1300 is not going to be resuscitated overnight. I understand they're not going to be resuscitated in my first hour I see them. If I see someone with a glucose of 1300, I know that they're going to be admitted, they're going to get fluids, and I'm on to the next patient. I'm not going to bolus them all 10 liters or 12 liters they need in the first hour. I am going to prime the pump, and then I'm going to allow them to be reassessed, and then I'm going to allow that fluid to continue on over the next hours to days until they're feeling better. So I'm not in any hurry. I'm just starting the process. I don't start the process at 10 mils per hour or a slow maintenance dose. I'm trying to prime the pump. So that's it. Team AJ was also talking about, you just can't give them a bolus and then walk away. That's crazy. Well, I don't think giving a bolus means that you just walk away from someone. If they're a patient that has a migraine, I'm going to give them a bolus of fluid and walk away. If they have a patient with belly pain, I'm probably going to give a bolus and walk away. But after I walk away, I end up coming back to see them and reassess them because that's my job. So I never really walk away from these patients and just let them sit and brew. I think you get, whether you give a bolus or whether you give it big, whether you give it small, you're always going to be reassessing these patients and doing multiple evaluations if you're truly concerned that they have a process that is going on that is taking a long period of time to correct. It could be your initial bolus, and then you walk away, you come back, and you see them again, and they're better. You don't have to go back and continually reassess it. The sicker the patient is, the more reassessments, the more time you're going to see what your treatments do. So bolus doesn't always equal walking away. Bolus just means you started something and you did something. Then Team AJ said, with a very subtle, well, this is more Team J, I guess, said with this really subtle comment, it may work in the majority of your patients, but don't you want to be able to treat all your patients? And I said, oh, that's so nice. I do want to treat all my patients. Maybe I'll just only pick half the charts. I like that. So I'm going to only now pick half my charts and then not treat the rest of them. Just let them go. That would be my own randomized control trial of treatment in the ED versus no treatment in the ED. And I'm going to publish it. And it'll be front page in the New England Journal. I know it. I know it'll. They'll like it, right? It'll go by the IRB. Not a problem. Now, so I think, again, this is a little misunderstanding of what I'm saying. So for me, the concept here is I like to make most of my patients easy and I don't put a lot of thought process into them. I give them that 2 liters. Or they come in and I know that they have a problem with their ankle. I'm going to quickly get them assessed. I'm going to touch them. I'm going to put my hands on them because they like that. And I'm going to sit down in the room. I'm going to tell them that they did the right thing for coming in the ER. But I'm not going to put cognitive time and energy into these patients. I'm going to make sure that they feel better faster and get them home. Make them simple, right? Most of your patients are simple. Then, if I make those patients simple, then I have my sicker patients and the rest of the patients. Those are my thinkers, right? These are the ones I have to actually think about and think, what should I do? They're the ones I do serial reassessments. They're the ones I do more ultrasounds. They're the ones I revisit and talk to more and consider, what am I truly doing with them? So I have my easy patients, and I make my easy patients easy, and I make my thinker patients think, right? Well, I do the thinking, I don't make them think, but I think on these people. And those are the ones where maybe I'll calculate their FINA and I'll get an osmolality and all those kind of things. But the rest of them, you don't need to do that on. Just make the easy ones easy, make the other ones put your time into. Now, to throw something back to Aaron and Jared, Aaron, I have to take a point with his aggressive maintenance fluids. Now, I think I've touched on this before, but I'm not a big maintenance fluid start in the ED plan. That is not my job. Why? Because I don't know when I'm going to turn over this patient. I don't know when that patient's going to truly go upstairs. I don't know if anyone's ever going to write a stop order to my maintenance fluids. So if I write a maintenance fluid, I don't write 200 mLs an hour. I write 1 liter over 5 hours. Now I know that that liter will be done in 5 hours. I'm not going to leave it at 250 mLs or 200 mLs per hour and then fire and forget and like, oh yeah, and then they've been sitting here for 2 hours, 4 hours, 8 hours, 20 hours, 3 days. Now all of a sudden they're the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and I got to send them to Jared in the ICU and get them diuresed. So I'm not a big aggressive maintenance person, but at the same time, it doesn't matter. Most of these patients, it doesn't matter. Start some fluids. Whatever you do, it'll probably be okay. In the last section, I'll give my quick answers to what some of the docs in the community were answering for Aaron, Jared. So creatinine 1.6, what do you do with that patient? Well, if it's a healthy person, and my question would be, why'd you get labs in the first place? Right? If you think they come in, they look good, and you're going to send them home, you don't need labs for that acute vomiting and diarrhea. You don't need the labs for that. Now, I know that may upset a lot of people, and people may like, oh, Brian, where you're going? You're going to get in trouble. And this, I said, well, you know, you have to do what you have to do. But what I will say is that what are you treating, right? Know what you're treating. Are you treating the patient because you think they have renal failure? Okay, Mr. Smith, did you pee today? Yeah, I've peed 3 times today. Okay, they're not in renal failure. Okay, they don't have a high K of 20, and they don't have a creatinine of 50 and a BUN of 300, right? This person is doing well because the body does really well. And so if I give them fluids and they feel better, I'm sending them home. Now, if you say, Mr. Smith, have you peed today? No, I haven't peed for 4 days. Oh, okay, well, that person needs labs, right? So if healthy people think about it, right, what am I doing with my laboratory test? Am I going for a disease-oriented outcome or am I really going for a patient-oriented outcome? A change in creatinine is a disease-oriented outcome. A patient-oriented outcome is renal failure. I'm not urinating. There is a difference between the two. So with a creatinine 1.6, I think they should go home. And I probably ordered the lab because I was concerned enough in this patient about some other process going on, and I agree that they should have follow-up and have a repeat creatinine checked. Do I check it in the ER? Rarely. Second point was on sodium. What is your sodium cutoff? And I have a kind of 120s is my discriminatory zone. Most people 130 or up will be fine, assuming they don't have a medical condition that needs to stay in the hospital. And most people in the 110s get admitted for sodium that's being low. 120s, I did, like one of the docs was saying, I kind of use it as a, well, do I think this patient needs to stay in the hospital? If they do, okay, their sodium's really low, you better admit them. If they don't, oh, your sodium will get better and you'll be fine. And after you give them some fluid, their sodium probably will get better as is. So I don't think there's a hard, fast number on sodium. I don't think there's a hard, fast number on creatinine. With what you admit and don't admit, look at the patient. If they need to stay, they should stay. If they are eating the Cheetos and drinking Kool-Aid and, you know, just running around the room and like, Doc, I want to go. I'm going to the game tonight. Okay, well, we'll let you go because they look good. That's all I have this month, and I hope that Aaron and Jared are able to throw some more softballs my way. It's very nice hitting their pitches. So you guys have a good spring, and talk to you next month.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Funny you should mention Kool-Aid, Brian, because it seems like you have a lot of people drinking yours. Your comments, as always, are very insightful. Or inciting. I'm not sure which to go with. Oh, who am I kidding? I can't stay mad at you. As much as we try to pick a fake fight or whatever we do on this program because it's entertaining, we hope that you can actually get a good message from this. You've got Jared and my perspective. You've got Brian's perspective. You've got a little view of the evidence now. And this is clearly something that is not well delineated in the evidence. There's not great evidence for either of our suggestions. But this is kind of a new and emerging topic. topic, which is why it's fun to talk about. So figure out what you want to do best for your patients. Figure out what you think you can study to try to add more to the resuscitation of these patients in the ED. And don't worry, Brian and Jared and I all give each other a big group hug at the end of this thing, and everybody's all right. So we hope you enjoyed this month. Congratulations again to our new interns that we matched. We are very excited to have you guys. We hope that you have an excellent next couple months. Enjoy graduation. Please go do something fun and exciting in between now and July 1st so that when you show up, you're happy, well-rested, and completely oblivious to what we're about to subject you to. In all seriousness, we're very excited to have you guys in Tucson. Bear down, cats, and good luck on the Elite Eight. Hopefully I don't have to eat my words next podcast. So happy March, and we'll talk to you guys next time.